Chapter 26. They no longer knew one another. They could not even recognize the uniforms. Often it was only by the helmets and the voices and the language that they knew they belonged together. The trenches had long since caved in. An irregular line of shell holes and bunkers was the front. It changed constantly. There was no longer anything there but rain and uproar and night and the light of the explosions and the flying mud. The sky had fallen. Sturmoviks had shattered it. Rain poured down, and with it, the star shells and the bombs and the grenades. Searchlights harried the torn clouds like white dogs. Anti-aircraft fire shattered through the uproar of the quivering horizon. Blazing airplanes came shooting down, and the golden hail of tracer bullets flew after them in a sheaf that disappeared into infinity. Parachute flares hung in indeterminate space and disappeared as though in deep water. Then the drum fire began again. It was the 12th day. For the first three, the line had held. The hedgehog bunkers had withstood the artillery fire without too much damage. Then the outer blockhouses had been lost, and the line penetrated by tanks. But a few kilometers further back, the tank defenses had contained the breakthrough. The tanks had stood burning in the gray of morning. A few lay overturned, their treads grinding for a while, like giant beetles lying on their backs. Disciplinary companies had been sent out to lay long roads and restore the telephone connections. They had been forced to work almost without cover. In 2 hours, they had lost more than half their men. Clouds of bombers swooped low and unescorted out of the gray sky and attacked the hedgehog bunkers. On the 6th day, the bunkers were out of action. They were no longer good for anything except cover. On the 7th night, the Russians attacked and were repulsed. Then it began to rain as though the deluge had come again. The soldiers were no longer recognizable. They crawled about in the sticky clay of the shell holes like insects that all had the same protective coloration. The company's position was now based solely on two ruined blockhouses with machine guns, behind which stood a few grenade throwers. The rest of the men crouched in shell holes and behind fragments of ruined walls. Raha held one of the blockhouses, Maas the other. They held them for 3 days. On the 2nd day, they were almost without ammunition. The Russians could simply have marched through, but there was no attack. Late in the last twilight, a couple of German airplanes came over and dropped ammunition and food. The men dragged some of it in and ate. During the night, reinforcements came. The work battalions had completed a log road. Weapons and machine guns were brought up. An hour later came a surprise attack without artillery preparation. The Russians suddenly bobbed up 50 yards in front of the line. Some of the hand grenades did not explode. The Russians broke through. In the flickering of the explosions, Graeber saw in front of him a helmet with white eyes beneath it, a mouth gaping open, and behind, like the gnarled living limb of a tree, an arm drawn back to throw. He shot at it, seized a hand grenade out of the fumbling hands of a recruit beside him, and threw. It exploded.
"Unscrew the caps, idiot!" he shouted at the recruit. "Give it here! Don't try to pull them off!"
The next hand grenade did not explode.
"Sabotage," shot through Graeber's mind. "Sabotage by the prisoners, aimed at us now."
He threw the next one and bent down and saw a Russian grenade flying toward him. He burrowed into the mud and felt the pressure of the explosion and a blow like a whiplash and a crack and mud that struck him. He reached back and shouted,
"Come on, quick, give it to me!"
And only when his hand remained empty did he turn his head and see that there was no longer any recruit there, and that the mud on his hand was flesh. He worked his way down, searching, found a string of grenades, pulled the last two off, saw shadows clambering over the edge of the shell hole, springing, running on. He crouched.
"Caught," he thought. "Caught. Overrun."
He crept cautiously to the edge of the shell hole. The mud protected him as long as he lay still. In the light of a parachute flare, he saw that the recruit had been splashed all over. A leg, a naked arm, the shredded body. He had caught the grenade full in the stomach. His body had absorbed the explosion and shielded Graeber. He remained lying with his head no higher than the edge of the shell hole. He saw a machine gun firing from the blockhouse to the right. Then the one on the left fired too. So long as they were in action, he was not lost. They had this sector under crossfire, and there were no more Russians coming over. Apparently, only a few had broken through. I must get behind the blockhouse, he thought. His head ached. He was half dazed, but in the back of his mind there was a thought, clear, limited, and sharp. This was what made the difference between an experienced soldier and a recruit. In the recruit, everything turned to panic, and for that reason, he was more likely to be killed. Graber knew he could play dead if the Russians came back. It would be hard to spot him in the mud. But the nearer he could get to the curtain of fire from the blockhouse, the better it would be later on. He slid over the edge into the next hole, slipped down the side, and got his mouth full of water. After a while, he clambered on. In the next shell hole lay two dead men. He waited. Then he heard a hand grenade and saw an explosion near the left-hand bunker. The Russians had broken through over there and were attacking from two sides. The machine guns flickered. After some time, the detonations of the hand grenades ceased, but the blockhouse went on firing. Graber crept forward. He knew the Russians would come back. They would look for men in the big shell holes. He would be safer in a smaller one. He reached one and lay there. A heavy shower fell. The firing of the machine guns flickered out. Then the artillery began firing. A direct hit was scored on the blockhouse to the right. It seemed to fly into the air. Morning came wet and late. Graber succeeded in slipping through before the first light. Behind a disabled tank, he came upon Zauer and two recruits. Zauer's nose was bleeding. A grenade had exploded close to him. The belly of one of the recruits was torn open. His intestines lay exposed. Rain was falling on them. No one had anything to bind him up. Besides, it was useless. The sooner he died, the better. The second recruit had a broken leg. He had fallen into a shell hole. It was incomprehensible how anyone could break his leg in that soft mud. In the burned-out tank, the middle of which had burst open, the black skeletons of the crew were visible. The torso of one was dangling outside. Only half his face had been burned away. The other half was grossly swollen, red and violet and split open. The teeth were very white, like slaked lime. A liaison officer got through to them from the bunker on the left.
Assemble beside the bunker, he croaked. Are there others over there in the shell holes?
No idea. Are there any medics?
All dead or wounded.
The man crawled on.
We'll get you a medic,
Graber said to the recruit into whose belly the rain was falling.
Or we'll bring you bandages. We'll come back.
The recruit made no reply. He lay pale-lipped, very small in the clay.
We can't drag you on this piece of canvas,
Graber said to the man with the broken leg.
Not in this muck. Rest your weight on us and try to hop on your good leg.
They took him between them and stumbled from hole to hole. It took a long time. The recruit groaned when they threw themselves down. His leg twisted. He could go no farther. They left him behind a fragment of wall near the bunker and put a helmet on the wall so the medics could find him. Beside him lay two Russians. One no longer had a head. The other lay on his stomach, and the clay under him was red. They saw still more Russians. Then came their own dead. Raha was wounded. He had an improvised bandage on his left arm. Three severely wounded men lay under a piece of canvas in the rain. There were no more bandages. An hour later, a Junkers plane flew by and dropped a few packages. They fell too far forward, into the hands of the Russians. Seven more men joined them. Some others collected in the bunker to the right. Lieutenant Moss was dead. Sergeant Major Reinecke took over the command. There was not much ammunition left. The grenade throwers had been knocked out, but two heavy and two light machine guns were still functioning. 10 men from the disciplinary company got through. They brought up ammunition and canned rations. They had stretchers, and they took the wounded away. Two of them were blown into the air within 100 yards. The artillery fire prevented almost all liaison during the morning. At noon, it stopped raining. The sun came out. It grew hot at once. A crust formed on the mud.
They'll attack with light tanks, Raha said.
Damn it, where are the anti-tank guns?
We've got to have some or we're finished.
the firing continued. During the afternoon came another Junkers supply plane. It was escorted by Messerschmitts. The Sturmoviks appeared and attacked. Two were shot down. Then two Messerschmitts came down. The Junkers did not get through. It dropped its bales farther back. The Messerschmitts fought. They were faster than the Russians, but there were three times as many Russian planes in the air. The Germans had to turn back. Next day, the dead began to smell. Graeber was sitting in the bunker. There were still 22 men. Reinecke had assembled about the same number on the other side. The rest were dead or wounded. There had been 120. He ate and he cleaned his weapons. They were covered with mud. He thought about nothing. He was now simply a machine. He no longer knew anything of an earlier time. He simply sat there and waited and slept and woke and was ready to defend himself. The tanks came on the following morning. Through the night, artillery, grenade throwers, and machine guns had kept the line isolated. Telephone connections had been reestablished several times, but they were always broken again. The promised reinforcements did not come. The German artillery was now very weak. The Russian fire had been deadly. The bunker had been hit twice more. But it still held out. It was really no longer a bunker. It was a chunk of concrete, wallowing in the mud like a ship in a storm. A half dozen near misses had shaken it loose. The men fell against the walls when it pitched. Graeber had not been able to bind up the flesh wound in his shoulder. He had found some cognac and poured it on. The bunker went on pitching and reverberating. It was now no longer a ship in a storm. It was a U-boat rolling on the bottom of the ocean, with engines dead. Time, too, had ceased to exist. It, too, had been knocked out of action. The men huddled in the darkness and waited. There was no longer a city in Germany where you had been living a couple of weeks before. Nor had there ever been a furlough. There was no longer an Elizabeth. All that had been simply a wild dream between death and death. A half hour of delirious sleep during which a rocket had soared into the sky and died out. Only the bunker existed now. The light Russian tanks broke through. Infantry accompanied them and followed them. The company let the tanks pass and caught the infantry in a crossfire. The hot barrels of the machine guns burned their hands. They went on shooting. The Russian artillery could no longer fire on them. Two tanks turned, rolled toward them, and fired. It was easy for them. There was no defense. Their armor was too heavy for the machine guns. The men aimed at the slits, but hitting them was pure chance. The tanks maneuvered out of range and went on shooting. The bunker shook. Concrete screamed and splintered.
"Grenades!"
shouted Reinecke. He gathered a string of them together, hung them over his shoulder, and crawled to the exit. After the next salvo, he crawled out under cover of the bunker.
"Two machine guns, fire at the tanks,"
Raho ordered. They tried to give Reinecke cover as he started to crawl in a circle toward the tanks in an effort to blow off their treads with the combined force of all his grenades. It was almost hopeless. Heavy Russian machine gun fire had set in. After a while, one of the tanks stopped firing. No one had seen an explosion.
"We got him!"
Immermann roared. He was no longer a communist shooting at his fellow party members. He was a creature fighting for his life. The tank was no longer firing. The machine guns concentrated on the second tank, which turned away and disappeared.
"Six broke through," Raha shouted. "They will come back. All machine guns crossfire. We must stop the infantry."
"Where's Reinecke?"
Immermann asked when they were able to think again. No one knew. Reinecke did not come back. They held throughout the afternoon. The bunkers were being slowly pulverized, but both continued to fire. They fired more slowly. There was very little ammunition left. The men ate canned rations and drank the water out of the shell holes. Hirschland got a bullet through his hand. The sun blazed. The sky was hung with great gleaming clouds. The bunker smelled of blood and powder. The dead outside swelled up. Whoever could, slept. They no longer knew whether they had already been cut off or still had communications. In the evening, the firing became heavier. Then suddenly it almost ceased. They rushed out in expectation of the attack. It did not come. For more than 2 hours, it did not come. Those 2 quiet hours devoured more of their energy than a battle. At 3 o'clock in the morning, the bunker was nothing more than a mass of twisted steel and concrete. They had to leave it. There were 6 dead and 3 wounded. They had to withdraw. They were able to drag the man with the stomach wound for a couple of 100 yards. Then he died. The Russians attacked again. The company now had only 2 machine guns. From a shell hole, they defended themselves with them. Then they fell back again. The Russians thought them stronger than they were, and this saved them. During the second halt, Zauer fell. He got a bullet in the head and died at once. A little farther on, Hirschland fell as he was running crouched over. He twisted over slowly and lay still. Graeber dragged him into a shell hole. He slid into it and writhed on the bottom. Bullets had torn his breast open. Examining him, Graeber found his blood-soaked wallet and put it in his pocket. There was now no longer any need to write his mother that he was alive. They reached the second line. Later, orders came to retire farther. The company was being disengaged. The reserve position became the front. They assembled a few kilometers farther back. There were only 30 men of the company left. Next day, it was restored to 120. Graeber found Freisenburg in a field hospital. It was a shed that had been inadequately converted to that purpose. Freisenburg's left leg had been shattered.
"They want to amputate it," he said. "Some lousy assistant surgeon. Only thing he can think of. I've managed to arrange transportation for tomorrow. Want to have an experienced man take a look at the leg first." He lay on a field cot with a wire basket over his knee. The cot stood beside an open window. Outside, there was a strip of flat land, a meadow abloom with red and yellow and blue wildflowers. The room stank. There were 3 other beds. "How's Raha doing?" Freisenburg asked.
"Shot in the arm. Flesh wound."
"Hospital?"
"No, he stayed with the company."
"That's what I'd expect."
Freisenburg's face moved. One half of it smiled. The other half with the scar stayed rigid.
"A good many don't want to go back. Raha doesn't."
"Why not?"
"He has given up. No more hope. And no belief."
Graeber looked at the parchment-colored face. "And you?"
"I don't know. This has to be attended to first." He pointed to the wire basket.
The warm wind blew in from the meadow.
"Strange, isn't it?" Freisenburg said. "In the snow, we thought it would never be summer in this land. Then suddenly it's here, and right away too much of it."
"Yes."
"How was it at home?"
"I don't know. I can't make any kind of connection between the two things, my furlough and this. I could do it before, but not now. They're too far apart. I no longer know what's real."
"Who knows that?"
"I thought I knew. Back there, everything seemed right. Now I no longer know. It was too short and too far away from all this. Back there, I even thought I wouldn't do any more killing."
"Many have thought that."
"Yes. Are you in much pain?"
Freisenburg shook his head. "This hole has something you would hardly expect. Morphine. They gave me a shot that's still working. The pains are there, but it's as though they belong to somebody else. I still have 1 or 2 hours to think."
"Is a hospital train coming?"
"It's an ambulance from here. It will take us to the nearest station."
"Soon none of us will be here anymore," Graeber said. "Now you're going too."
"Perhaps they'll patch me up just once more and I'll be back."
They looked at each other.
Both knew it was not true. "I'll believe it," Freisenburg said. "At least for this hour or two of morphine. A section of life can sometimes be damned short can't it? And then comes another one you know absolutely nothing about. This was my second war.
What will you do afterward? Have you decided?
I don't even know yet what the others are going to do to me. I've got to find that out first. I never thought I would end up this way. I always believed it would catch me properly. Now I have to get used to the idea of having been half caught. I don't know if it's any better. The others seemed easier. There was an end of it. The bloody nonsense no longer mattered. He would pay the price, and that was all. Now one's in the middle of it again. I had made a sort of pretense that death canceled everything and so on. That's not how it is. I'm tired, Ernst. I'll try to sleep before I begin to realize that I'm a cripple. Take care of yourself. He held out his hand to Graeber.
You too, Ludwig,
Graeber said. Of course, since I'm swimming with the current, the primitive impulse of life. Before it was different, but perhaps that was just a deception. Always a last secret hope hidden in it. Means nothing. One always forgets one can make an end of it oneself. We got that gift along with our so-called mind.
Graeber shook his head. Freisenburg smiled his half-smile.
You're right, he said. We don't do that sort of thing. Instead, we'll try to see to it that all this can never happen again. To accomplish that, I'd take up a gun again if I had to. He laid his head back. Suddenly, he looked completely exhausted. When Graeber got to the door, his eyes were already closed. Graeber went back to his village. A pale evening red colored the sky. It had not rained again. The mud was drying. In the neglected fields, flowers and weeds had sprung up. The front was rumbling. Suddenly everything seemed very strange, and all connections dissolved. Graeber knew the feeling. He had often had it when he woke up at night, not knowing where he was. It was as if he had fallen out of the world and floated in complete loneliness in the dark. It never lasted long. One always found one's way back, but each time a strange, small feeling persisted that someday one would not find the way back. It was not fear that one felt. One simply shrank into oneself, like a tiny child set down in the midst of a gigantic step where every road of escape was 100 times too long. Graeber stuck his hands into his pockets and looked around. There was the old picture. Ruins, unplowed fields, a Russian sunset. And, opposite, the pale, beginning heat lightning of the front. It was there as always, and with it the hopeless chill that went straight through the heart. He felt Elisabeth's letters in his pocket. Warmth was in them, tenderness, and the sweet excitement of love. But there were no quiet lamp to light a well-ordered house. They were will-o'-the-wisps above a swamp, and the farther he tried to follow them, the more treacherous the swamp seemed to become. He had wanted to put up a light in order to find his way back, but he had put it up before the house was built. He had placed it in a ruin. It did not adorn it. It only made it more desolate. Back there, he had not known. He had followed the light without question, wanting to believe that to follow it was enough. It was not enough. He had fought against this realization as long as he could. It had not been easy to see that what he had hoped would hold him and support him had only isolated him. It could not extend far enough. It touched his heart, but it did not hold him. It was swallowed up. It was a small, private happiness that could not support itself in the limitless morass of general misery and despair. He took out Elizabeth's letters and read them, and the red afterglow of sunset lay on the pages. He knew them by heart. He read them once more, and again they made him more lonesome than before. It had been too short, and the other was too long. It had been a furlough, but a soldier's life is reckoned by his time at the front and not by furloughs. He put the letters back in his pocket. He put them with the letters from his parents, which he had found waiting for him at the company office.
There was no sense in brooding. Freisenborg was right. One step after another was enough. One ought not to try to solve the riddles of existence when one was in danger. Elizabeth, he thought. Why do I think of her as of someone lost? I have her letters here. She is alive. The village came closer. It lay there, dismal and abandoned. All these villages looked as though they would never be rebuilt. An avenue of birch trees led up to the ruins of a white house. A garden had once been there. Flowers bloomed, and at the edge of a dirty pond stood a statue. It was a faun, blowing on his pipes. But no one came to his festive noon. Only a couple of recruits were there, searching the fruit trees for green cherries.